Time once again to scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Our guest, John Dombeck, has written prose, poetry, and commercials. We'll talk about that. And Garrison Keillor, though, is sticking to the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. John Dombeck, it's a pleasure to have you on Scribble and to identify you as a writer.
Thank you. Thank you. I don't know if that's all true or not, but I appreciate the honor.
Well, I'm impressed by the variety of things you've done. And that's no joke, prose, poetry, and commercials. He wrote some of the funniest commercials you can imagine. Chicken Motors was
I remember some of those commercials, and one of the questions I have down on my list to ask him is, I might as well ask him directly, he's here. Is there a difference between writing a poem and a commercial?
No, I don't think so.
Writing is writing.
Yeah, exactly what it is, and you have an idea that you want to get across, whether it's selling oatmeal or selling heart or selling, what, sex, I guess. No, there's not. The difference, if there is any, is the mood itself. In my case anyway, I have to close my eyes and get into a mood and try to visualize what I'm writing about. In the case of a commercial, it's fun. Because if the client allows you to be funny and still sell the product and not insult it, you know, that's fun to do. Because I like to entertain with a commercial rather than just to say, oh, come and buy my vacuum cleaner, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, you did some very funny commercials through time. Mm-hmm. But what impressed me is that you've written a children's book.
Yes.
What prompted that?
I woke up one morning with the first sentence going through my head, and it was a great first sentence. I can't remember it now because I don't have the book, but I couldn't get rid of the sentence. It kept going over in my head, and it was so. I just sat down and said, "Okay, I'm going to finish this paragraph, whatever it is." And paragraph turned out to be a little book.
The moon was there, but not for long. Oh, I glanced away, and it was gone.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the and then displays a billy goat lounging in an overcoat, watching a turnip playing ball bump his head into a wall and trip into a waterfall.
which was the line that
you need help?
The opening line. you
But the opening line isn't necessarily a children's line. Right, I could imagine Walter
Lemire
saying that. Right, what turned it into a children's book?
I think the rhyme of it. I wanted to continue going, and I wanted to rhyme it, and that's what made it. Then also, I wanted to make it silly and ununderstandable to an adult, but very clear to a child, and so that's why I did the foolishness in it.
Yeah, a silly lady sitting there rocking in a rocking chair while brushing stardust through her hair and reading to a polar bear.
Yeah, no, that's not a very adult right.
No,
thought.
No, but it starts out neutral, right? And somehow, at some point, that's what I thought was interesting about that. It becomes a children's rhyme.
Yeah, I don't think it was intended.
But it turned into it.
Yes, it did. It just kind of rolled out, and I finished it, basically.
Yeah, but you you write articles for a magazine still?
Yeah, Echoes Magazine in Maine, which just now published its last issue, which is real sad.
You drove them out of business?
I write down the tubes if they are gone forever. No, I write a column for it. And it was a wonderful magazine to write for because they allowed me to write on whatever subject I wanted to write. The magazine itself was nostalgia from a county in Maine that is very community oriented. And so most of the stuff there is about somebody's grandmother. And I was able to get the job to write there by a book about my brother and I that I wrote, Joe and Me. I don't know if you knew about that one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they were all nostalgic growing up, you know, changing from mm-hmm. a boy into a man, that kind of thing. So now they allow me to write political. I wrote one I really enjoyed writing is an article about women's rights having to do with its particular church that says women are wonderful and everything, but votes no minimum, no equal pay for the women, equal to men for the same job. So I wrote on that subject. And that particular one got praise from the readers and just awful, awful rejection from one reader in Tennessee. I decided not to take my vacation in Tennessee.
My home state has taken a turn for the worse.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Don, but, you know.
Yeah, I'm no longer responsible for Tennessee.
So that was kind of it.
But then... Yeah. So you've written columns, you've written a book, you've written for children, and you write poetry.
Yes.
How do you decide which direction you want to take in your writing, or do you? Are you methodical about this? Or?
No. I guess I'm glad you said, or do you, because it just, if something is bothering me emotionally, it could be politics or it could be a bad love affair, you know. Mm-hmm. If something reaches to the point where I said, I got to say something about that, then I either write a letter to Orrin Hatch because I don't want to, you know, because he's the most. I either write a letter to Orrin Hatch or I write something about the politics. Uh-huh. And I don't, in most cases, in many cases, it's not intended to be published. I write it for myself. And then, but in the case of like Orrin Hatch, I want him to look at it and see if he'll change his mind.
You make me think of Harry Truman. He would sit down and fire off a letter and put it in the drawer, and his assistant would come and read it and then think, this is not going to go anywhere, and so it doesn't. And the only reason that letter to the critic about his daughter, Margaret, made it is because that guy was sick that day.
Oh, really?
So someone picked up the letter and posted it.
I love it. That's good. Fate.
Yes. Truman would just express all of his emotions in writing, but they never saw the light of day. But poetry. You occasionally gift me with a poem. Gift us with one now.
Let me clear my throat here.
Okay, I'll cut your mic.
I think I'm coming back. Yes, I'm back.
Okay, well, not all the news is good. read the one about...
Dandelions or the stars?
The stars.
Okay. Actually, it's kind of a life and death one.
Uh-huh.
It is a life and death one, I guess. I imagine this one, in case you're wondering, what's death going to be all alike? It sounds somber, awful, but keep listening because it isn't. Yeah. I will miss the stars. Just as my eyes are closing for the final time, perhaps while watching the sublime wonder of the Milky Way's endless displays of galaxies and stars, I will know this fading glance is my final dance. With everything I know, I've been told not to regret that I go. Rejoice. I will become one in the incomprehensible mystery, saturated in joy, awaiting me. Perhaps so. Still, I will miss the stars.
I love that.
I like that last line.
Yeah, I will miss
that. It reminds me a lot of one of Emerson's great phrases is, this isn't an exact duplicate because I don't remember it, but if the stars should come out one night every 1,000 years, how men would look up and worship and wonder.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that.
That's true. Yeah. I've been fascinated by the stars all my life. And to me, it's one of the most spiritual things I know of are photographs from the Hubble telescope.
Yeah.
And the immensity of space and the wonder of it all. And then that really engages me right there.
And leads me to the other question I want to ask you, because you're in a unique position of having moved from lush environments like Maine and ostensibly the Quad Cities out to the desert.
Yeah.
And President Treadway and I used to have a constant argument about whether what you did something in this place or that place made a difference in an old frowsy library or in a modern little, you know, no-nonsense room. Does being in the desert change your writing? Or would you write that same thing in Maine?
I don't know if I could answer that clearly. Maine's beauty, which is not spectacular, it's greener like here. I wrote about that. I wrote mostly about the fall, autumn in Maine, how the leaves... One of the lines I wrote was, I like the leaves fall and make a blanket for the winter. So that's from a walk I took in Maine under the pine needles that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And I wrote something about that. In the desert, I wrote about the harshness of it, that it's beauty, but it's harsh beauty. And because if you go, like I have a little side garden, and whenever I go out there to do some work in it, I always come back with a thorn in my finger or a thorn from the cactus that's out there. So it's stand back and look at the cactus, and it's appealing. It's really wonderful.
But it seems to me there's something specially haunting about a desert, and it probably is no accident that some of the world's major religions arose in the desert, from the desert fathers, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Darwin in the Voyage of the Beagle has a passage about going out into the desert in Patagonia and just spending the day there awestruck and almost unable to come back.
Yeah.
Terre de Chardin was moved to write about his theories about the origin of life sitting in the Gobi Desert. And he sensed the landscape throbbing with life in a barren place. And he came up with this theory that what we call consciousness is implicit in all atoms. It's only when things evolve and get very complicated that suddenly this consciousness folds back and sees itself.
Oh, that's very nice. I like that.
Yeah, that in a desert.
Yeah.
Well, I'd read the Stars poem, and it seemed to me like a desert poem. Rather than a Maine poem.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you can see the stars in Maine, too, but not the way you can in Utah, can you?
I'm thinking that it was less having to do with the environment and more having to do with what the heck is in this magnificent universe is out there and kind of disappearing into that when you die, basically. Mm-hmm. And even though it's magnificent and even though it's... Well, more than magnificent. I should have a better word than that. It's ultimate, and I will miss this common, ordinary life when I go. You know, see that.
Yeah.
That's. I don't know if it had to do with it with that not at all.
You have a dandelion poem. Is it? Dandelion, or what?
It's dandelions.
Dandelions.
Dandelions. Disregarding truth.
Disregarding truth.
And this has to do with life itself.
Okay.
And how, because life wants to continue itself and just keep on going no matter what, whether it kills something else or, you know, what. So it's very, very persistent. And in this, there's also some adultery. And the dandelions are blossoms when they die. They have a little parachute, you know, and they go flying into the air. You've seen this, I'm sure. You haven't seen this? The wind blowing dandelion blossoms?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's what the adultery that's happening here. So it's called Dandelions Disregarding Truth, and I will speak slowly, Don, just for you. Dandelions blossoms, scoffing at apples, green and sour, gripping flimsy limbs, absent their flowers, having had an affair with the wind, wave seductively to bow to honeybees, knowing their flimsy parachutes will succumb to the same mistress and fly later in summer in search of eternity.
Man, you invest these things with the, you load a lot in there. Read your other poem there.
Okay. This one, I'm glad I can read this. Got a little emotional with this because it's my wife and I had a 60th anniversary. She's a wonderful woman, and I got mad at time.
Well, I went through a 60th anniversary. It wasn't too bad.
Okay, here's called Lecturing Time. I'm talking to Barb. Barb, why did 60 years with you have to pass so quickly? Why couldn't time have slowed down for a second or two? I'm going to ask him. Listen up, time. Think about it. I'm not asking much. You have the power. You bend and curve yourself all over the place, way out there in space among the stars. And when you do that, you change the courses of galaxies. Why couldn't you have let up a little with our time together? You could easily could have stretched a second into 10 seconds, easily. Maybe during a kiss or a hug, or even during something less extraordinary than her smile. How about an everyday thing? You know, like washing dishes or bathing babies or brushing a speck off my suit as I left for work. That would have been seriously easy for you. But no, you didn't give an inch. You whipped by our 60 years together with no concern for how wonderful we feel when we're together, no matter what we're doing or saying or playing, loving each other like no other. Come on, time. Give me a break. Ease up for a day. It's our anniversary.
That's good.
I always get choked up. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, that's one of the problems with aging. I find myself profoundly moved sometimes just by a line or music and so on. You lose that stoic control that you prided yourself in.
Yeah.
Except, of course, Tweet, you remain in control, right?
Yeah, right. No, I don't. But I never was completely in control. But no, I think as you age, you allow yourself.
Oh, yeah. Why not? Why not? Why not enjoy the richness of a feeling or an emotion? Savor it. You know, those are good things. Well, Johnny, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today. And keep writing. Oh. Now that you've killed off the magazine.
I don't want to ruin the publishing industry, Don.
But, you know, will you continue to write? And what will you write? What kinds of things will you continue to write?
Well, I'm working on a book now that we talked about earlier, a book about how my wife discovered her mother, or trying to discover her mother. And so I'm going to finish that. I was going to do it just for the family because it was such a wonderful discovery and all. But it turned out, as I was beginning to write it, that I think that people would like this book. And everyone I talked to kind of explained little bits about get a lump or they, know, they feel emotional about it. So I'm going to do that, Don. And I'm always, and I will continue to write poetry. I'm not quite as frequently. I don't know what's happening, but I don't know. It's kind of slipping a little bit.
Yeah, well, there's always that alarm bell goes off when I see your email address. Oh, no, not at all.
Well, I'll never.
John Tombeck, a writer of many, many different things, from prose poetry to commercials. But right now we're going to go to Garrison Keillor. I think he'll give us a poem, but he's really interested in the Writer's Almanac. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. And thus, briefly, to the book bag.
Okay, well, it's a little too briefly for me. This is a book I'd like to talk about half an hour on, but a book that I've been going to read for 40 years and just somehow never did, and it's the perfect book to follow John Dombeck. It's Henry Beston's The Outermost House. In 1927, young Henry Beston bought a few acres on Cape Cod on the seashore, built a two-room cottage, and went there for 2 weeks intending to spend his vacation there, ended up spending a year taking notes and observations and writing about the waves and about nothing that happens on Cape Cod, the birds and the animals. He hadn't intended to write a book, but he was engaged to be married, and his future bride said, "No book, no marriage." So he sat down and wrote The Outermost House, which turned out it wasn't terribly successful when it was published in 1928, but Rachel Carlson called it the one book that influenced her most in writing Silent Spring, and it has gained a following. It has been in print ever since 1928. It is an incredible book. He has no agenda, no even environmental agenda. He just observes nature. Let me just give you a short passage, and then you can hold your hand when it's almost time to quit. It's fall, and the insects have disappeared. Here it is. Animal life has disappeared into the chill air. On the surface, nothing remains of the insect world. That multiplicity of insect tracks, those fantastic ribbons which grasshoppers, promenading flies, spiders, and beetles printed on the dunes as they went about their hungry and mysterious purposes. Those trillions of unaccountable lives, those crawling, buzzing, intense presences which nature created to fulfill some unknown purpose, or perhaps simply to satisfy a whim for a certain sound or a moment of exquisite color, where are they now in this vast world, silent save for the somber thunder of the surf and the rumble of the wind in the porches of the ears? As I muse here, it occurs to me that we are not sufficiently grateful for the great symphony of natural sound which insects add to the natural scene. Indeed, we take it so much as a matter of course that it does not stir our fully conscious attention. But all those little fiddles in the grass, all those cricket pipes, those delicate flutes, are they not lovely beyond words when heard in midsummer on a moonlit night? I, too, like the movement they give a landscape with their rushes, their strange comings and goings.
That's beautiful.
This is an incredible book.
Yeah. Well, if we want people to read it, you better give us the title and the author again.
Henry Beston, Beston, and the book is The Outermost House. Okay. I've known about this book most of my life, always going to read it. Finally, last month I did, and this is the perfect time to talk about it.
Excellent. And this is time for us to go. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll come back next week for another edition of Scribble.